This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
November is Diabetes Awareness Month, and suddenly we're all seeing blue circles everywhere. But behind the symbols is a condition that quietly shapes the lives of millions of us and our families. And with new tech like tiny sensors sitting under the skin, the way we manage diabetes is changing fast. So it's a perfect week to explore what's actually happening inside our bodies. So what is the real story behind diabetes? Associate Professor Teresa Larkin from the University of Wollongong is with us again. Teresa, always good to have you on Drive.
Nice to be back. Thanks, Warren. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. When we hear the word diabetes, we often think of sugar levels, but what's actually going on inside the body when someone's got diabetes?
Yeah, that's right. We really link it to sugar and high sugar in the blood. But the word diabetes, it actually means passing through, and that's in relation to the urine. So there's a couple of different kinds of diabetes. The first one's called diabetes insipidus, which means bland. And then the other kind of conglomeration of the ones that we know about is called diabetes mellitus. And the miel is honey in Latin, and that means honey sweet. So actually they were named that way because people first describe them by tasting the urine. So people who have diabetes insipidus, meaning bland, that's different to the diabetes we know about, and it's where they have a deficiency of a hormone that normally stops you from overpeeing, basically. So these people just pee and pee and pee. They have heaps of urine, but it's really dilute, so that's why it's called bland. Whereas people with diabetes mellitus, which includes the diabetes that we know of, they have really high blood sugar, but what that also does is as it passes into the kidneys, it brings extra water with it. So people with uncontrolled, especially type 1 diabetes, they can also have extra urination. But because there's sugar and too much sugar in the blood that's passing through into the kidneys, it's not able to be reabsorbed. Their urine also often contains sugar, which it shouldn't. So the glucose. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that diabetes mellitus, that's the grouping of the type 1 diabetes, type 2 diabetes, and gestational diabetes. And they're all really, though, about insulin. So type 1 diabetes is where there's literally not enough insulin. Type 2 is when it's reducing and the effects are not as good. And then gestational diabetes is insulin resistance in pregnancy. So it's all about insulin, but the net result that people know about in their plasma are the high sugar levels.
Well, can you walk us through what insulin does for us day to day and why it's such a big deal when that system stops working properly?
Yeah, so insulin is a hormone produced by the pancreas, and that's really just in response to increased levels of glucose in our blood after eating. So it's interesting that most other hormones in the body, they're stimulated by changes within our body. So, you know, waking up or changing temperature or something. But this hormone from the pancreas is really made and secreted purely in response to the glucose levels in our blood. So its main role is that it promotes storage of nutrients. So once we've eaten, you know, we've got the building blocks of proteins and fat and glucose all coming through from the food, and they're broken down, they're absorbed into the blood system. And so when they're running around in the blood, though, they can't do anything. So what insulin does is that it actually binds to receptors on cells, and it moves what's called glucose transporters to the cell, so that then essentially the cells have these doorways that glucose can travel through to go into the cells, because the cells need glucose, you know, as energy for whatever functions they do. And I guess the biggest problem is that our brain needs a continuous supply of glucose. So it's only our brain's only around 2% of our body weight, but it uses around 20 to 25% of glucose at rest. So, yeah, it's one of those things when you are reminded of that, it really makes sense as to why we can feel fatigued, you know, when we're using our brains a lot. And that's at rest, you know, what our brain is using. Imagine what yours and I is working on now.
I'm so glad you said that, because sometimes, you know, I haven't done anything physical, but I might have done some mental work or what have you. Even after doing radio for 2 hours, I find that, you are drained, in a good way, but the energy is lower than what it is before you start. And I always wondered, because I thought, I'm not running around the block.
I totally agree. I found that when I had sort of some ongoing COVID issues with fatigue, and it was work. It was going back to work, and it was doing that kind of activity that was actually the most impactful on my fatigue. You know, like, I got to a stage where I was better off going for a walk or trying to do a jog or something and reducing the work that I was doing. And it was a real eye opener for me to realize that that mental energy really costs a lot. And it kind of then also comes back to thinking about when we're doing, you know, excessive worry, or when we're ruminating, or we're using our brains unnecessarily. It's also, you know, such a lot of energy. But yeah, so basically the insulin, it enables the glucose that's in our blood to be taken up into cells so that they can do their work. It also is what enables us to store those nutrients in between meals, so that then when we haven't eaten for a few hours, we can still gradually let the glucose back out to get to our brain. So for example, glucose can be stored as glycogen in the liver and in skeletal muscles. It can also be stored as fat. And then when we haven't eaten for 4 hours or more, then also the pancreas helps to release the glucose back into the bloodstream, so then it can go to the other organs where it's not stored, so that it can get to the brain, for example, throughout the day, whether or not we have just eaten.
I wonder if that's also why, you know, when you do go through a period of high stress, sometimes you can lose a bit of weight as well. Is it because you're consuming so much more glucose in the brain?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And also because the stress hormones actually stimulate the fat cells to break down their lipids so that they break off and give us the energy back into the bloodstream. Because any stressful event, the body thinks, oh my gosh, you know, I'm going to need to run, I'm going to need to fight, I'm going to need energy. And so it needs that energy circulating in the blood. And so, yes, again, that's actually true. It's a good question, is the links between even stress and a sort of a risk of having high blood glucose.
Teresa, when it comes to treatment or prevention, what are the most helpful things we can do to support our own blood glucose health, and how is diabetes treated?
Yeah, so it's one of those things where diet and exercise come up straight away, and they've got really legitimate reasons. So one of the things for everyone, and to really prevent that type 2 diabetes, which is the one that can develop later in life, and it's mostly related to obesity and being sedentary and sort of inflammation. So diet and having a lower glycemic index, which is where you have those foods that are more complex carbohydrates or dietary fiber, not just, you know, sugar rush
not
foods,
the yummy foods.
Because they then, yeah, exactly, yeah. Not the little piece of Mars bar slice that I just had before this, before this interview. So that's right. All those, like, you know, good foods, because it just means that there's less of a glucose spike, which means that there's less load on the pancreas to try and then secrete enough insulin to respond to that. So diet is really important. And some people who have early type 2 diabetes, that's literally the go-to. You know, they'll see a dietitian. And then exercise in this as well, because actually exercise increases the uptake of glucose into the muscles. Oh. It's amazing. It actually does the same thing that insulin does. So on the muscles, insulin, and insulin does this in the liver and the fat tissue as well. Insulin puts those glucose pathways essentially on the cell, so glucose can go into the cell. Exercise does that as well on the muscles. So exercise basically enables your muscles to take glucose up. So it's something that's really good. Even if someone's, this is probably good advice coming into this happy, the silly season. Even if, you know, you've had a little bit of a sugar overload, if you can just get up and walk a little bit or do a few squats or something like that, it can really help to take that glucose load off the pancreas.
Wow.
But with type 1 diabetes, that's the type that's, it used to be called insulin dependent. That's an autoimmune disease. You know, it's where the pancreas is being destroyed basically by the body's own cells. And so that's that very different kind that's usually in young people. they need insulin. So the type 1 diabetics are the people who they literally are not able to produce enough insulin. And so that's necessary for them to live. And usually that's given in injections. So you can get all sorts now of like short acting, long acting. And so people might give themselves a short acting one just before they're going to eat something, but then they'll have regular long acting ones during the day and in the evening so that they've got a steady release of insulin overnight, for example.
Teresa, my mother, before she passed away earlier this year, she had diabetes. And, you know, the poor woman, she was 81 years old and she was doing her finger prick test and, you know, injecting insulin. And then she was forgetting because she, you know, she couldn't remember what she had and it was becoming a nightmare. And then this device came along and it was quite expensive. And I thought, bugger it, I'm not having my mother do all this stuff. And I got this thing, she wore this patch. And she didn't have to do the finger pricks anymore. She just scanned either on my dad's phone or scanned this device and she could get her blood glucose levels. It was amazing. And I was so thankful that it came in, you know, the last sort of few months or year of her life and she didn't have to do these things anymore. Treatments are changing, aren't they, in the way we monitor things?
Absolutely. Those continuous glucose monitors are amazing for people who need them. So usually the people with type 1, but later type 2. And that's where there's a measurer, so like a sensor that goes into the fat that's just under the skin. So it's not deep or anything. And that is, it's taking readings of the glucose that's traveling around those cells. It's basically the same as what's in the blood. And like you say, it can be hooked up to go back to a phone or even some people then have an insulin, like an automated insulin delivery that's also attached into their subcutaneous fat. And that then it can, in some people even, it can automatically tell how much insulin needs to go in. Or the person can read it and say, oh my goodness, you know, my glucose is this low or this high, and that means I need this many units of insulin. And so injecting it into the fat is good because otherwise insulin is a hormone that's made up of amino acids and it would be broken down in the stomach and intestines if we gave it orally. So putting it into the fat, it means it's absorbed nice and slowly, although some of them get absorbed fast. And it's usually better tolerated, although it's hard when people have to continually inject themselves through the days.
The other thing this device did too is like if she had a hypo overnight, it would sound alarms on my phone and my dad's.
So wow,
it's amazing. The way it's so exciting the way that treatments and technology is advancing. I love it. Teresa, I love our chats. We've run out of time because it's 6 o'clock.
I know.
We have to go to the news, but I could talk for another half an hour. Thank you so much. We'll chat to you next
thank
time.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us.
Chat
Teresa.
Next time.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Associate Professor Teresa Larkin from the University of Wollongong.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.